Dr. Kidder, why do you call the book The Gift of Caregiving?
Two reasons. One, I got sick and tired of hearing and reading about the burden of caregiving, as though that was the only model there was. And I was inspired one time a couple of years ago to hear a man whose wife had Alzheimer's disease talk about the wonderful gifts that he had received from her through the process of caring for her. And that just kind of stuck in my mind. And so when I was thinking about my personal experience as a caregiver and recognizing what an opportunity it was for me as a human being to be a caregiver for my mother, and I remembered what he said, I thought, I want to kind of balance this notion of burden with the notion of gift.
Yeah, it does. It leaves nobody unchanged. You know, when I say you see a caregiving situation, everybody's affected one way or the other. And I find that so many of the professionals and the advocates that I've met, if you drill down, you see there's a core caregiving situation there.
Absolutely. We continually, where I work, do programs and trainings for caregivers. And very often the people who come are professionals who work in the aging network. But then as the conversation continues, what we see is, oh yes, but they are also caring for their husband with MS, caring for their mother with dementia, and so on. And there are very few folks that are just walking one path of caregiving. We learned about your activities when I happened to go to an event in Philadelphia and saw you do a Fearless Caregiver Conference there about 11 years ago and saw how empowering that was to the people in the audience and said, wow, this is something great we should be doing in Connecticut. So we've been very happy to bring it to the people here, and we've seen our numbers grow like crazy.
Well, it's a great partnership. I appreciate it, and I look forward to this year's event. You say in the book that caregiving was actually time-limited 100 years ago due to the fact that people only lived an average of 47 years, and now they can live over 100. What other changes affect caregiving today that weren't an issue so many years ago people need to pay attention to?
Well, one of the things in my short lifespan, I was a hospital social worker for years, and people had open-heart surgery, people had cancer care, whatever they were treated for. They were in the hospital a long time. And then after the hospital, they would very often, once Medicare came out in 1965, they would go for 2 or 3 months to a nursing facility for additional care, and maybe even stay longer than that. So the family caregiver did not have to be a medical expert, if you were. Well, but now, with significantly shorter hospital stays and with the great push to keep people out of nursing homes, family caregivers are, you know, having to perform functions of nurses, of physical therapists, of dietitians that they didn't have to have before. So the training piece for caregiving is very important. People really need to have some idea about what they're doing. I recently broke my arm, and you know, I wasn't in the hospital for that, but after the doctor did a little this and that, at the next visit he turned to my husband and he said, okay, here's the plan for physical therapy, here's the equipment you have to buy, she needs to do it for, and suddenly my husband had to become my physical therapist. He was strengthening and moving my arm, and he was putting me into this traction thing and making me pull up and down on equipment. That never would have happened before. You know, you would have had in-home services by a licensed physical therapist. But times are changing, some of that driven by finances. So I think that's one piece. The sophistication that a caregiver needs, I think, is tremendous. The return to the workplace can't be minimized. The fact that women are not home to provide long-term care, particularly to parents, they're not home, they're not available in the day to do that. So that has created a shift that has caused families to start looking at other resources, such as adult daycare. so that someone could still be living at home but be somewhere safely in the day so that they're getting some monitoring and professional care and supervision but able to return to the family at night. That's something that didn't exist previously. One of the other things that we're seeing as far as the need in services for caregivers, for working caregivers especially, at least in the Northeast, hospitals are regionalizing. So a short time ago in Connecticut, we had more than 30 acute hospitals, and now we probably have half as many. Larger hospitals are buying up smaller hospitals. In doing that, they're centralizing their services at whatever location they specialize in this or that. So you might live in New Haven, but the best place that your hospital provides chemotherapy might be in Stamford. Well, that's up to the family caregiver somehow to figure out, how do I get someone to Stamford four times a week for this or that? How do I get them, you know, to another part of the state for physical therapy? And with the regionalization of healthcare, more efficient, more cost-effective for the providers of care, but creating more of a burden on family caregivers to access those services. So that's something new that I see happening.
And one thing we see at the Fearless Caregiver conferences all the time that people have challenges with is communicate with the loved one you're caring for.
Yes. Absolutely. One of the huge issues with the advanced age of the population is the increased incidence of dementia. And dementia isn't a light switch that goes on and off. You have it and you don't have it. It's a process. And you're continually having to assess the person you're caring for, where are they in that process? Because your communication style is going to have to change in response to that. And the individual's ability with the dementia to participate meaningfully in decision making and communicate their needs and wants to their healthcare providers, to their social service providers, that's going to need to be continually reassessed. And maybe the family has to assist with that communication to make sure the individual is getting what they need and what they want. In our area, there's a very nice little commercial that a paid caregiving company is running. But I really think it speaks to the issue of communication. The company is saying, we listen to the needs of your loved one and we make sure we match them with a caregiver who knows how to meet those needs. Easy talk. But they show this little vignette, and here's this person who loves a certain kind of ice cream. And the family knows what kind of ice cream it is, but the person with the dementia doesn't remember what kind. She just knows she wants ice cream. And they're trying to give her ice cream, but they're not giving her what she likes. She likes this butter brickle. She's not getting her butter brickle. But the daughter, through communicating with the paid caregiver in a communication loop, could call it by what this woman recognized. And then you see the paid caregiver going out and buying it. And the next day, there's this very happy consumer sitting eating ice cream with her paid caregiver, feeling so much happier, enjoying herself so much more. And those kind of pieces, and that's like the most basic, easy level, you know, ice cream brand and flavor. But then you get up to these, you know, much more complex issues around healthcare needs and medication. All of that, the family caregiver continually has to be involved in that communication loop, interpreting my family member who can no longer communicate effectively for themselves. What do I know about them? What do they need? What do they mean when they say something? And making sure that the other members of the healthcare team and the caregiving team understand that. So I think that's really an important piece.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, something that happened when we were together at one of the events in New Haven, at the end of the morning session, you know, a caregiver raised her hand, said, I don't have a question, I just want to tell you something. And it's this very story of why I always say the caregiver should be the CEO of Caring for My Loved One, Inc. And she told the story about how she made her mom, who had dementia, who she was trying to get home care into the house, want to make her mom into what she called the chairman of the board. And before the home care company came for the first time, she sat with her mom in a yellow pad, very professional, and said, okay, I'm going to hire an assistant for you with your work, Ma. What is it you'd like? And then that night, after the aide had left, she says, okay, Mom, you're the chairman of the board here. What do you think about what happened? And, you know, is there anything else you'd like? And her mother thought for a long time, and she said, you know, it's all okay, but I wonder if maybe she could take me for a walk downtown to get some ice cream. So that ice cream reminded me of that. And so she says, yes, I'll add that too. So it is, you're right, it's communication and involvement and interaction. That happened at your event, and I share that story all over the place. I think it's just great.
Yeah. I can't minimize it. You know, it's just so important. And that's something, when you talk about the differences between paid care and family care, but there's no way the paid care person has the relationship in the beginning to be able to get that information. But the family caregiver may not have the time to take the person for that walk at 11 o'clock down to the center to get ice cream because she may be at a job. But that working together and communicating, the person ends up getting what they need, getting their need met in the way they want it. So that whole notion of the team communicating and the individual who's receiving the care being at the center of it, being the chairman of the board, as you said, it's so important.
Yeah, it's a really nice section in The Gift of Caregiving about the relationship between the paid caregiver and the family caregiver and down to expenses. And I thought, you know, if you are the CEO, if you're the manager of services, you have to know how to manage the role of the family caregiver. It's towards the end of the book, and I just thought that really made a lot of sense to bring that up because I really don't hear anybody talking about that.
Me either. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to say, I have to give credit to one of my college professors, Abraham Monk, who really a man for 60 years worked in aging. And he talked very much in all of his classes. He was a sociologist, and he talked very much about knowing the difference between what we do for money and what is a paid contract and what the expectation is in society on that versus what we do out of informal relationships. And it doesn't matter how nice the paid caregiver is and how much they like you. They still are there in a paid role that has certain expectations. And there's only certain things that they're expected to do. And if they do more, they're really doing more than what their job allows them to do. That's not part of the contract and so on. But there are no such contracts on family caregivers. On family caregivers, you do whatever your heart tells you and your capacity enables you to do. So that although they have similar goals and purposes to keep the individual healthy, safe, happy, etc., their capacity to deliver that role is different based on the fact of one is a financially based relationship and one is a relationship based on love and affection and affiliation.
Yeah, and actually it's that concept that you can fire your doctor, but your doctor can't fire you for the most part.
Yeah.
You go in and you can actually say, I don't like what's going on here without feeling guilty about how you're hurting the aide's feelings, you know, and then that's how we get. We're caregivers. So that's a training, in a sense, that caregivers have to say, to see, do I like it? Do I understand what's going on? Is there anybody that I can complain to? And maybe it's a possibility that I better change aides because I'm not comfortable. And it's that strength, it's that internal strength we have to find in ourselves. And keep talking about family dynamics for a second. You have another segment in the book where you talk about a family that you were a teenager and they lived down the street, and the brother Tony, fact that it's a few years later, not many, but a few years later from when you were a teenager, and these people who are under the older brother Tony's thumb are still scared about what it's ingrained in their selves. Tony has physical problems. He could never reach out and stop them from doing anything. Could you go into that story? Because I think that says a lot about ingrained family dynamics.
Well, it's a story about a few women, as you say. And these women, a tight-knit family, and it was the job of Tony. I mean, he wasn't just overstepping. In his family roles, it was his job to be protector of his sisters and make certain that his sister stayed the straight and narrow path and didn't get in trouble. And, you know, that meant a lot of things for young ladies of those days. But mostly it meant, like, boys. That was, like, really a big part. Boys probably drinking and smoking were, you know, girls in trouble. And those girls grew up with that feeling, Tony will kill us if we do this. Tony will kill us if we do that because, you know, we might get in trouble. So you flash forward many years forward, and there's a school reunion, and there's an opportunity for these women to get together with some other women who had been classmates of theirs, and they were all going to go on a trip together, and everybody was really looking forward to it, and these women said, oh, we can't. These are grandmothers. Tony wouldn't let us. Tony would be so upset because that's not, you know, what nice girls do. And it was just so overwhelming to me that so many years later, here's Tony, this man who himself probably needs a caregiver, you know, so limited in his ability to, in any way, do anything to limit them, to stop them, you know, physically, socially, in any way at all. They were still living under that specter of what Tony says has to go. When you have family relationships like that and those kind of family dynamics, to think that you could say to these women about an important issue like making a caregiver decision about their parents, that they would do what they thought was right or what made sense for them without permission from Tony, it's ridiculous. And I see that all the time in counseling families, and it's why when we're doing long-term planning with families about what's going to happen to the person they care for, I always try to get all the parties to the table, because absent an important figure there who could be the veto power, for instance, on a decision that we think we've made, plans don't work. And you get them to the table and you begin to see the informal power that many relatives have over the other, some based on their role in the family as far as their position, you know, firstborn, youngest, whatever, sometimes based on their gender, just mama's favorite, whatever. Those things all have to be factored in understanding what caregivers can do and how they think and how they make decisions. And then it's a place, if you're working with caregivers, that you can help empower them to look at their patterns and say, wait a minute, this is a new era. I'm another person. I'm not the 16-year-old high school girl in bobby socks. How relevant is what I'm fearing? You know, how real is it? And is this really the basis of my decision making? So, yeah, I think about those sisters often.
What would be the one most important piece of advice you would like to leave family caregivers with?
Well, I don't like to give advice, so I won't do that.
Okay.
But I will tell you the lesson that I learned for me, and I believe it's true for anyone who opens himself to it, is this is not only a sacrifice. This is an opportunity that you're given later in life to really become the full you that you were intended to be, to really come to understand yourself, grow, stretch, and really be who you want to be, fully present in life, doing what you know inside, deep inside yourself, is the right thing to do. And we all have a different sense of right where it is, but that you really, through this experience, get to grow in compassion, get to grow in love. These are wonderful gifts, to be able to still be growing, whether you're 40, 50, 60, 80, 90 years old, still growing and developing as a human being. I think that's a wonderful gift.